From Little Rock Public Radio, this is Insight with Jonathan Seaborn. Each week, I host thoughtful conversations with people helping to shape our civic, cultural, and economic life right here in Central Arkansas. The Arkansas Symphony Orchestra is in the middle of a remarkable transformation, one that goes far beyond music. It's a story about leadership, community, and rethinking what an arts organization can be in a modern growing state like Arkansas. My guest today is Christina Littlejohn, Executive Director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. Under her leadership, the symphony has expanded its reach, navigated significant challenges, and recently opened a new state-of-the-art music center designed to serve musicians and the broader community alike. Today, we'll talk about that journey and what it takes to lead through change, how the arts can bring people together, and what the future holds for the symphony and the community it serves. Thanks for joining me today, Christina.
Thank you for asking me, Jonathan.
So I would like to start from the beginning of your time with the ASO. You stepped in when the symphony was on the brink of bankruptcy. It was a really challenging time for the organization. So my first question before I get to how you turned it around is, why even accept that? Why step into that position?
I came here because on my interview weekend, there were so many people that showed up to say hi and to meet me. There were musicians. I remember Susan and Rafa, Leon, and there were other musicians that were there. And then there were members of the board, and then there were life members, longtime donors of the board. There was Lee Rennell and Gus Pratsenis and George Mitchell, and then there were the staff members. And I was just, and Ellen Gray, and Martin Toma, and so many people came to the interview reception, or just that I thought this orchestra this orchestra has a lot of supporters. There are so many incredible people that care about the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. And then after the reception, Lee Rennell pulled me aside and he said, "Christina, we just need a leader. We need someone to tell us what to do. And I promise you, if you come, we'll do that. We will follow you and do what you ask. We just need this orchestra here in our community." And how can you say no to that? You have to say yes. You have to say yes to Lee anyway, but you have to say yes to those words as well. So
I went through a similar experience through my interview process here too. Like it was refreshing the enthusiasm that I witnessed from the community about the station. And we've talked about this. Little Rock really does feel like it punches above its weight class with access to these sorts of things, these sorts of amenities. For a city of this population to have a world-class symphony, to have the ballet that we have, institutions like the Rep and so on. So it is good to know that you came in and that support was there, but then you had to face the challenge of how to turn that around. What were some of the first things you started to look at?
Well, when you're turning things around, there's only so many levers you can push, right? Pull. There's the cut expenses, and then there's the increase income. And so we had to pull both those levers. And one of the things, Martin Toma was our board chair at that time, and Martin said, make the expense cuts to the edge of the cliff, but not over the cliff, because what we really want to do is be able to survive right now and thrive later. So we put together, the other thing I love about Little Rock is, and the Arkansas Symphony is, we put together a team of musicians and staff and board members. So we all got in the room together and worked on a financial recovery plan. Because in order to solve our financial crisis and the habits and to change the habits that had gotten us to that spot, it was going to take everybody understanding what the problem was and then figuring out a solution to the problem. And so we ended up with the staff and the musicians taking pay cuts. And then we did have to eliminate a couple positions on both the musicians and the staff, which that was really hard. And then the board increased their giving dramatically. So we had a $500,000 problem that we needed to solve. We had a $500,000 structural gap. And so the musicians and the staff owned $200,000 of the problem, and then the board owned $300,000 of the problem. So the board increased their giving, and the board started asking our supporters to give more money and ask them to contribute. And so we have broken even. We're headed towards 17 years of breaking even. And our assets at that time were around $3 million. And now our assets are close to $27 million.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Martin's got a lot of great things to say. One of them also was never waste a good crisis. And so one of the things that was so critical at that time was building that culture of team. And so we've used that same model of making sure the musicians and staff and board members and community members are in the room when we're making big decisions. And we include everybody in strategic planning. But all those, many of our committees include all three constituents. So mm-hmm. it's really, it's a lot of fun to be part of this organization because there's a lot of team success and team joy and team celebrations. It's all of us that worked hard and all of us that created the success. So
yeah. Is it out of that process that your current membership model was born, or did that come later?
That came later. The concert membership that we have is like Netflix. So people pay mm-hmm. $9 a month and they can come to all the concerts that they wish. And so that actually came from, we also brought in a consultant, John Limbacher. John came in, and my mentor, Bruce Kopic. I called Bruce when I was like, oh my goodness, this is really bad. And so Bruce and John helped us analyze how big the problems were, financial problems were. And John has stayed with us for a long time. Both Bruce and John worked with St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And so I think the concert membership was probably, it came out of St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And so because we were working with John, we adopted it as well because we could watch our subscription pattern dropping. The generations of people that want to subscribe and guarantee their seat and are willing to pay you $1,000 in March for concerts that will happen the following March and April are dropping. They're dropping everywhere. And so the concert membership just made a lot of sense to us as we were looking for a different product to try to increase the number of people that come to lots of our concerts. The Arkansas Symphony and all the orchestras, but us is who I can speak to, we live or die by individual donations. So donations to our annual fund are what we live or die by, and people that donate to our annual fund are people that come and enjoy our concerts. So the more we can make it easy for people to come to lots and lots of our concerts, the more likely it is that we'll be here for generations. So the concert membership really was copied from St. Paul Chamber Orchestra.
There was a lot of innovation that happened those first couple of years. Yeah. And then you get to a place where I imagine you're feeling somewhat normal, 10 years down the line or whatever it is, and COVID hits.
Right.
And then you have to reinvent the wheel again. There's a massive success story there in y'all's transition to kind of digital performance. I don't know what the term that you used, but I mean, millions of views, right? Worldwide? Can you speak a little bit to what the decision-making process was to dive into that?
Right. Our culture of all working together, supporting each other, the musicians and the board and the staff. During COVID, I'm so proud of how all the constituents turned on a dime and pivoted and made things happen. So the board committed to paying all full-time musicians and all full-time staff and paid the per service contracts through May. And so anyway, we committed to making sure no one had to go on furlough. So we're one of the few orchestras I'm aware of that continue to pay full-timers at 100%. And because everybody was getting paid, that one of the things that was helpful with staff was there to be able to support musicians. And Drew Irvin, our concertmaster, came up with this idea of Bedtime with Bach. And so at 9 o'clock every night, one of the things all of us were able to count on was there's going to be a lullaby from one of our musicians. And so Drew started it, Bedtime with Bach, 9 o'clock, and over 100 nights, you could count on that. There was so much chaos during COVID, and you didn't know what you could count on, but you could count on our musicians to be there. And someone locally wrote Washington Post when they asked for good things that were happening and told them about Bedtime with Bach. And so Washington Post interviewed us, then CNN picked it up, and then Kelly Clarkson picked it up. And so Drew got to actually have an interview with Kelly Clarkson and be on the Kelly Clarkson show. And that, of course, helped spike it. And so it turned out over 1 million people watched it in over 30 different countries from around the world. Mm-hmm. And so that was truly beautiful. So we were able to continue our service to the community We were able to continue to support our musicians and staff, and we were able to do so and be fiscally responsible because we were still serving the community and doing things, people were still giving to us. And our subscribers were so loyal, and so there was a whole lot of loyalty going on to make sure that the symphony was still here. So we were able to continue to do a lot of things that a lot of people couldn't, and it's because I still believe it's because we're all there to support each other, and we work so well together, and our communication is pretty clear together. So,
yeah. How do you, you know, there's the difficulty of transitioning into what does normal look like during the abnormal,
right?
But then there's the difficult process of transitioning back to where we are today, of opening back up, you know, you're reemerging into the world. So what was the process like for the ASO to move back towards normal after COVID?
Right. Well, we did right before COVID in July of 2019, the board approved moving forward with a $10 million campaign to raise money for a new music center, new Arkansas Symphony, Stella Boyle Smith Music Center. And it made that decision in July of 19 to move forward with that big, giant project. And thankfully, again, because everybody was still employed, we were able to continue that campaign, and we were able to continue to raise money for that and our service. And so getting back to normal still included this great, big goal that we had, and at least it was a nice happy that we had to look forward to. I mean, it was hard work to raise the money, of course, but we at least had this big giant goal that we were all behind and all trying to make happen. So during COVID, and I think our organization still, our guidelines are, during COVID, it was keep everybody healthy. So keep everybody safe, keep people paid, serve the community, and do so in a fiscally responsible manner. If the PPP money had not come in, we would have had a different story, but we were able to hang on, and then the PPP money happened. So we were able to continue to do all of those things. And so those things still hold true today, except, well, we obviously want to keep everybody healthy, of course, but serving the community, keeping people employed, and being able to hire more musicians is our goal. And then doing so in a fiscally responsible manner is always there as well. So I guess when we went back to normal, we still had those same principles, and we were raising money for our music center, and we were then... we had to change the design that we had originally because during COVID, we watched and saw a real need for a sound booth and a video. Mm-hmm. Our kids were coming into our space and making their college audition tapes. And so we wanted to make sure that we still had that capacity. And so we revised our plans and added that into the new center. And so we had a whole lot to get excited about.
Yeah.
And again, I thankfully had not lost staff. Like, there's so many people that when they had to... when they had to furlough staff, or when they had to everybody took pay cuts, they lost a lot of staff, and we didn't do that. And so our staff sustained, and so it made it, I think if we had laid people off, we wouldn't have pulled that off because we would have been in the middle of trying to hire and retrain, but everybody was still there. So everybody was able to just now at least be able to do it together in a building at the same time.
Yeah. When I imagine, you know, like with the Bedtime with Box stuff, it's something that, as you get back to normal, it's obviously not sustainable. There's so much stuff you have to do.
Yeah.
But it's so popular that I imagine it was also probably a little hard to move on from at the same time.
Well,
or were y'all ready?
I think it was us and people were ready. So people were ready to see each other in public. So they wanted to see the orchestra together. They wanted to be in the hall. So I think it was a mutual decision. our participation from the public had dropped as well as so. Yeah. I think it was a mutual decision.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Well, then what was the spoiler alert, y'all? You complete the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The building is now open. It's beautiful, by the way.
It's beautiful. First of its kind in the country, state of the art. It's amazing.
What was that? That's a massive undertaking. And you're talking about something that ended up now taking. It was over 5 years, right? I mean, like total from 19 to 24.
Yeah. And actually we can look back at our notes, and it was thought about in 2014. So the entire process took 10 years from thinking and then looking around and exploring and things like that to actually opening the music center. So, but yeah, July of 19, and then we had raised the money by August of 23, I think is when we broke ground, or July of 23, right around there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I was a year off, but still, I mean, there's a lot of time and sweat and energy.
Yes. Invested it's really hard. That. Yeah.
What was that feeling like that day after the, you know, the shovel hit the dirt?
I mean, we were just so excited. So one of the mandates from the board was to make sure we did this in a fiscally responsible way. Nobody wanted to go back to the dark days. We lived through the dark days and no one wants to go back there. So it's still part of our consciousness. So it's part of our memory. if we allow ourselves to go back to those dark days, it's still there in our memory. But so breaking ground, the goal was COVID increased some prices. And so the goal had moved from 10 million to 11.75. And when we broke ground, we were still $500,000 away, but we were at a spot where we were just, the longer we waited, the more the prices would increase. So we went ahead and broke ground with $500,000 to go. And within 2 weeks, I got a call from Jim Wallace, and he said he and Pat wanted to have lunch with me, and they committed that last $500,000. So we knew as that building was coming up that we'd already paid for it. And in addition, we had $1.25 million for our endowment to help operate the building. So so that was a so then it was just fun, because then we were just picking out the furniture and working with Bailey Construction, who was fabulous, and WEA Architects were amazing. And so we got to work with them and had to have weekly building meetings with those guys. And it was awesome. It was so much fun, because then you're like, oh, has this been delivered? And anyway, it was a treat and a trip, and it was fabulous.
Yeah. Which, can you speak a little to what this building represents for the symphony? I mean, yes. I know this is, it is your space.
Yeah.
And how is that different from the space you occupied before?
Well, the real impetus for the Music Center, there, again, it's three-prong impetus for the Music Center. When we were in our old space, the old space was falling down, and it really just, we couldn't get all our projects done. There was a need for string education instruction, and we were having to teach kids outside. And then if it rained, they had to run in with their violins. That was awful. And then we were teaching in storage rooms where all the Opus ball stuff was and the Christmas trees, and those kids are just in there and all these things might fall on their head. Like, it was safe, but it was also just old and there wasn't enough room. And so the Music Center had the goal of service. We'd be able to do way more programs for the community in our own space. Education, artistic, we'd be able to attract, we'd be able to serve our musicians more. It's got some private practice rooms, et cetera. And then financially. So financially, having our own space is just, it's a statement to the community that we're here forever. So when people are considering their endowment gifts, they can just go to our space and look and go, oh, okay, I can make a gift to the endowment because it will be permanent. It will live on for generations. Anybody that wants to can just come to our music center, and you'll probably see, assuming you come from the hours of 3 on, you're going to see a bunch of kids and their parents in the center using it and learning music together and playing music together or singing together. It's such a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful space. And so the goal was to serve the community, grow artistically, and then financial foundation. So by having that music center there, it shows everyone that we're permanent. It also allows us to do a lot more innovation and creativity. So our chamber series, River Rhapsodies, we used to do at the Clinton Library. Now we can do it in our space, and we've been able to add a matinee and see how and serve more people with a matinee show for that. And we can experiment by doing more free concerts, because we're not paying rent. It's our building. So we're able to experiment and test some things a little bit more. And then, like, with the recording, so we're hopeful we have a couple new recording projects in play. Jeff's working on them, so hopefully we can tie the knots on those. And so it's really, but it is so nice to be able to give potential donors a tour of our center, so then they can actually see where their money goes and who we're serving and how we're serving people. And again, it provides a lot of financial stability to help grow our endowment, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'll say, you know, you mentioned the free concerts, mm-hmm. and I know there's lots of events that the symphony puts on that are aimed at things that are family friendly, or like you have like the Beethoven and Blue Jeans and right. these other things. There does really seem to be a strong emphasis on accessibility and openness. And I was curious if you could speak a little bit to why that was important in the new model for the symphony as y'all have opened up this space. Right. And I know some of this existed before the space, but.
Yeah. No, thank you for asking that question. It is super important to us. It's fair. Like, I was talking to somebody earlier, and I'm like, part of it is personal for me. I grew up in a house where no one plays an instrument. I only learned it because of my school. It was offered at my school. And there's this thought that symphony music is only for, like, everybody loves classical. Everybody loves music. And there's no, so I want to make sure that we have a space that everyone in the community can come and hear music because we all love it. And we all want to have a space where we're building community as well. And so the accessibility piece is extremely important to us because I want to grow community, and I want people from the children's choir has children from 25 zip codes across our community. They're not neighbors, and they get to know each other, and everybody gets to like be reminded that we have way more in common than we don't. And so the accessibility piece is just making it possible for everyone to come here. So also we are a nonprofit. We're a nonprofit philanthropic organization here to serve the entire community. We're not here just to serve 1%. We're here to serve everybody. And so why would we not want to embrace that? And so, so like when Robinson was reopened, we did a free concert to thank the community for Robinson. We didn't mm-hmm. do Black Tie. We didn't have yo-yo. We did a free concert. With the Music Center opening, we had we wanted it to be the community. So I put together, building use task force and included people from leaders from the different community to come and say, talk about how this could be their space, yeah. not the symphony space, but their space. And Darius Nelson was on that task force, and he was the music minister of St. Maur Baptist Church. And I'm sorry, I get teary-eyed every time I talk about Darius because he was just such an amazing man and he died suddenly. And so, but he came up with this idea. He said when he walks into the music center, he wants to know that he belongs there. And with that work of that task force, we came up with the aspiration for the music center to be a radically welcoming hub of musical activity for all Arkansans, because that's who it's for. And music is for everyone. And music should be accessible, because it is. We don't have to be able to speak the same words. We can all be moved by the rhythm and the melodies.
It's universal.
It's yeah. universal. And so why not embrace that? That makes it way more possible for anyone to walk in that music center, like Darius said, feel that they belong. And so that's our aspiration. When we opened the center, the music center, that we wanted that statement really reflected in how we opened it. And so Darius's gospel choir from St. Mark Baptist, we did a program where we arranged music so that our musicians were playing with a choir, and it was beautiful. So that was part of the grand opening. And then we later performed at St. Mark Baptist for one of their Sunday services, and that was beautiful. So are there ways in the music center can provide more partnerships, and we can all add one and one and come up with magic instead of two, right? And so that there's so many reasons why this is important. There's so many reasons why it matters, and you can see it in everything that we do with a concert yeah. membership. I had a woman say that she was just now coming above the poverty line, and that $9 membership is really so important to her because now she can go to all the concerts. And I was like, holy cow, okay, I'm glad we have this because yeah. music is for all of us.
Which, and I know that we talked a little bit about the membership model earlier. Mm-hmm. It really is innovative. It's been recognized nationally. I think we touched on that earlier. But can you speak a little bit to how what the ASO is doing is different than your normal membership model you might see at a different symphony?
Right. Yes. We were included in the New York Times for this because the New York Times reporter said, why aren't more of your colleagues doing this? I said, I don't know. I just don't know. And so It is different. And again, I don't know why they're not doing it. So I was on a panel last summer, and I was on the panel, and Cleveland Orchestra has membership. Their membership is, I think you pay $25 a month, and that entitles you to be able to buy a ticket at a different, at a lower price. And then other memberships are more like Cleveland's, where you pay a fee and that enables you to buy a ticket at a cheaper price. And so ours is just flat out just like Netflix, except cheaper, because Netflix is now more than $9 a month. So when we're cheaper than a movie, but we're cheaper than Netflix, but ours is modeled after that. Because our goal, our long goal is to drive donations to the Arkansas Symphony, which come from people that enjoy your concerts more than once. The churn rate, so single ticket buyers, people that come to one concert, the national churn rate, and this tracks for us as well, is 90%. So 90% of the people that come to an Arkansas Symphony concert never come back. Mm-hmm. Or they might come back after 3 years, but we're basing it off of 3 years, right? So 90% of them at least don't come back for 3 years. So you're only hanging on to 10. So you've got 10% that might come to a second concert or a third, that'll come to a second or a third. Whereas with a membership, sometimes people are just becoming members right out the gate. The members are using the membership one group is using the membership like 5 or 6 times a year, super users. One third aren't using it at all, but they like to be able to say they're members of the symphony. Yeah. And who doesn't want to be a member of the symphony? We all want to be members of the symphony, just like with public radio. Yeah. We want to be members of public radio. And so there's some that are just members, and then there's that next third that are coming maybe 1 or 2 times a year. So it also helps the subscription model was set up so that it made it possible for orchestras to be able to program more than just Tchaikovsky.
Yeah.
Because your subscribers going to 6 concerts, so you could have Tchaikovsky, you could have Britten, you could have some unknowns in there, but they're going to come to all 6 because they've got their seat. So losing that really impacts how you think about programming. Mm-hmm. And I would say in not necessarily a good way, because we want to be able to program more than just blockbusters. So the concert membership, if we can talk to them about what they're going to experience at the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony, or talk to them about what they're going to experience with Dvorak. And by the way, you already have a free ticket, so come on and check it out and explore. And so it gives us a different way of being able to talk to people than with trying to sell an individual concert. I mean, obviously Carmina did brilliantly. Carmina mm-hmm. was practically sold out. Both Saturday and Sunday. So we want to do a Carmina. We wanted to have a Planets, but we also have to want to be able to perform Britten and some other things that aren't going to be natural sellouts.
Yeah, and I guess I'm kind of surprised to hear that the churn rate was that high at 90%. But I would also imagine that 10% is extremely loyal. Like that is the same. It's a constant. Revisiting from that 10%.
Right. Yeah. I would think so too. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also great to hear that those membership model patrons, that the churn rate is much more balanced throughout that.
Yes. The members, we figured out the annual churn rate. Well, the annual retention rate for members is close to 78%.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it's really high.
So near 80. Yeah.
Subscriptions are close to 80% retentions as well. So so it's real close to your subscriber retention, which is great.
Yeah. As we say all the time when we're telling people the difference between, you know, like we get this question, which I'm sure you do too. Why become a sustainer? Like, why is that better than a one-time gift or so on? And, mm-hmm. and being able to have some clarity as you move forward in your budgeting and knowing that, you know, we rely heavily on that $5, $10, you know, $15 a month, whatever it may be, $9 a month in the membership model. Yeah. You talk about doing things responsibly from a fiscal standpoint, and that, I imagine, lays a stable foundation to do so. That knowing that you have that retention rate with that model, you're almost guaranteed that 80% of that year over year for your planning.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And we also found during COVID, our concert members didn't leave us either, mm-hmm. which was shocking, because if they were going to leave, that would be a fine time. We weren't doing any concerts, but they hung in there and stayed with us too. So that is a loyalty It's a loyalty as well. Yeah, so that does help with budgeting, and subscriptions obviously are the still the gold standard to help with budgeting as well.
So, but it's just that, you know, the importance of that guaranteed money for the institutions you support versus the one-off is it does make life a lot easier.
When we were analyzing how to, what our, how, when we had to analyze how big was our financial problem back in 2009, we looked at sustainable revenue versus sustainable expenses. And that's where that $500,000 gap comes from. You might be lucky and one of your Pops concerts does extremely well and you end up making money off of it. But you could also be unlucky and it's snowing and there's ice outside and you miss your single ticket sales goal by a whole lot because there was pouring down rain outside. So, yes.
There was 2 feet of snow or whatever.
Yes. So the sustainable model is your annual fund donations, your subscribers, and your members. That's for sustainable revenue. Oh, and earnings from the endowment as well. So,
yeah.
We work really hard to grow that sustainable revenue. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of all the, and I hate to, I guess I don't hate it too much because I'm going to ask the question anyways, but of all the kind of new programs that y'all have implemented since 2009, whether it's a concert series, an educational program, some sort of access point, is there one that you're most proud of? Do you have a favorite child in that sense?
I mean, other than the Music Center? Music Center is my favorite child, for sure. It is absolutely my favorite child. I think my favorite is more the value of accessibility and the value of building community and the value of making a space where everyone feels knows that they belong, and the accessibility piece, I think, is the value of accessibility, the value of belonging, those values and how we've implemented them. The children's choir this year was free. We're looking at, we had an intro to violin class that was really $80 and we provided the violin. We're working on making one of our other education programs even more accessible. The $9 membership, the free kids tickets, that's free for all the kids under 18 to come with their, with a paying adult. Bank OZK is a sponsor of that this year, but it's, and I was just, it makes the concert so fun. So I was just at a concert. Tanya Leon was our composer. She was in town. She's in town. She's like 82 years old now. And I was walking with her during intermission. And during intermission, it was the coolest thing in the whole wide world. There was a guy there with his white t-shirt on and he spoke to her. And then the next person was his 20-year-old with blue hair and her partner who had pink hair, and they wanted to shoot the bull with Tanya. And then, you know, then we move on, and then we're standing by the elevator, and this 10-year-old little boy comes up to his big, giant glasses, and his little sisters are hiding behind their dad's leg, but he wanted to tell Tanya how much he enjoyed the concert. And it was just simply beautiful. And I said, Tanya, have you ever seen a more diverse audience ever in an orchestra concert with your music? She's like, no. Like, it was just beautiful how many people were there together experiencing this music together and having fun together. And I'm most proud of that. Yeah.
Looking back on where you started from in 2009, could you have imagined that this is where you would be sitting in 2026?
With our beautiful music center? No. Honestly, 2009, 10, 11, those were really, really, really hard years. You know, we did have to lay off, thankfully, it was just one, but we had to lay off a musician. We eliminated a string quartet. That was really hard. And the staffing, I just lucked out, man. I totally lucked out on that one. We're able to hire some just smart, curious people that wanted to do a great job. David Renfro was our principal horn. He was on a search committee, so I'd just been kind of watching how diplomatic and thoughtful he was, and And we had an orchestra personnel manager position open up. Because the other thing, when you're having to lay people off, your other people leave. They just like, oh, this is not a good place to be. And they take off. And so we lost our operations person. And so I just watched David in those search committee meetings. And thankfully, one day, when I had a person quit, I was like, oh, gosh, David Renfro would be perfect for this. So David came into the building probably to teach a horn lesson. And I was in the stairway and we both went, I want to talk to you. So he'd also been thinking about getting a job at the symphony. So thankfully that worked out. And he's been with the symphony. He's now our chief development director, a chief revenue officer, in addition to being the principal horn still. And so I just really lucked out with a great staff, putting together a great team to get us through those few years, because those were years where they were really hard. Nobody likes state pay cuts. And they let you know that they're not happy with their pay cuts. And it's, and the musicians, like one of the musicians was like, we're playing beautifully. We're playing the best we've ever played. And I don't know why we have to take a pay cut. And I'm like, I am so, so, so sorry. Every word out of your mouth is totally true. You're exactly right. It's not your fault. And I am so grateful that you guys are willing to be part of the process to get us out of this. So I try not to think about those years.
Yeah.
So I think at that point, all of us were so focused on survival that we weren't dreaming at all. It was just about survival. And I will say during COVID, there were definitely moments that I never saw the Music Center actually happening. We had a potential donor say, I'm not giving to that project because I'm not even sure there'll be a symphony. I'm not even sure there'll be a symphony in a year. And I was like, that just isn't true. We'll be here. But those were also really dark times. And so then, no, I didn't see, like, there were definitely days where I didn't see the Music Center then. But then, thankfully, we have a great group of donors. And we also had a great case. Like, that was it, too. It was, we had to get the Music Center done because I still had kids that were, they were taking lessons outside in the rain, right? That had to stop. So there were still people that needed us. And so we had to keep moving forward with raising the money for the Music Center. But I know in 2009-10, that was, dreaming was not on our list.
Just survival.
Just survival was on our list. Yeah.
Well, you've been extremely successful with the symphony over, you know, the course of these 17 years or whatever it's been. And we're grateful that you've taken the ASO to where it is. And I'm curious, you know, what keeps you here? I imagine that with the degree of success you've had and the ASO is constantly getting national recognition, that, that there probably is other opportunity. So why, what is it about Little Rock that, that keeps you tethered?
Well, Little Rock is a beautiful place and people are really, really nice here. I have a lot of great friends. I go to a great church. I'm part of a hiking group. Like, if I want to play my cello, Bevan will let me play at my church sometimes. And so there's that. Little Rock is, and it's an easy place to live. Good grief. You can, I could zip my daughter around to swim practice and to Wildwood and still make it happen. Now she had to eat her pizza in the car, but we could still make it happen because it's just so easy to get around here. But the Arkansas Symphony, what keeps me around is we have a great board that's willing to be courageous. The Music Center is the first of its kind, the only one, and it's state-of-the-art in the country. We looked around to see if there was anybody we needed to model ourselves after, like to give us some kind of tips as WR as they were built, you know, designing it, but there were not any. Ours is the only one, which is why we have people from across, my colleagues from across the country that are coming to check it out and look at it and ask me how they can build one where they are. So our board is courageous. Our musicians are willing to... Our musicians want to be part of that journey, and so they're part of the journey. Like, we're all on the same team together. And then the staff is amazing. Our staff retention's around 9 or 10 years, and we joke about how you can never leave because our former staff members are part of the guild, and they're volunteers, and they just appeared all these times. And so that's great. And then we're courageous, and we haven't – this board is willing to do things differently than anybody else. We're in the New York Times because we were willing to do the concert membership. And he couldn't find it. Like, we were one of three orchestras, St. Paul, us, and then I think Cleveland was in there. And the COVID, we were one of a few. I know St. Paul did, but I don't know any other orchestras that kept their full-time musicians and staff employed at full pay. Our board has the courage. Our Jane Hunley's our board chair. She's very courageous to not have to follow what Cleveland is. We're not following anybody. We're mm-hmm. willing to go ahead and be the organization that's out front. Tawny Leon and I were having a meal, and she said, "What's it feel like to be miles ahead of everybody else?" And I was like, "Sometimes it's really scary. During COVID, was really scary." I was like, "Shouldn't we?" I'm like, "All my friends are taking pay cuts." Jane Hunley's like, "We're not doing it." I was like, "Okay, okay, okay." You know, and then the music center, that's not scary at all because that's just beautiful. But yeah. Now it's all fun because now I've got all my friends. Someone from Bellingham, Washington's coming on Monday. Somebody else, from Portland, Maine, talked to me last week. We have people all across the country looking at this music center. So that's what keeps me here. We get to keep being courageous and we keep to, oh my goodness, I'm so excited. Like the Morgans gave us that gift this spring, $1 million gift, 200 a year for 5 years to add our education program. So we were able to add that children's choir. We had 100 kids audition and we were able to select 50. It's led by amazing teachers. Then we've got the intro to violin class. We're going to be adding some more programs next year. Our goal is to grow all our intro people that can check out all the string instruments so that we can continue to have a robust youth orchestra. I haven't gotten bored yet. That's why I'm here. I'm not bored yet.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's exciting to, like you said, there's no one to follow because we're leading.
Yeah.
And it's exciting to be a part of something that's cutting edge.
Yeah, it really is.
And so all of our listeners that are interested in learning more about the center, about membership models, what you have going on for the season, all of that's available at the symphony's website, correct?
Yes, at arkansassymphony.org. You can find out about all our programs there. And at the end, you can probably enroll and find out when we've got a summer strings program coming up and who knows what else. Oh, we have a new family series next year, concert series. So, yes, check out our website and keep checking it because there's probably going to be more stuff. There's always something fun happening at the symphony. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Insight with Jonathan Seaborn is produced in the heart of Central Arkansas by Little Rock Public Radio, a service of UA Little Rock. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast or on the NPR app.